Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do the Al-Qaeda attacks of September 11, 2001 mean to the United States a decade later? And have the lasting changes in the name of security and domestic and foreign intelligence been good or bad for U.S. citizens? Siyam Brown is John Goodwin Tower, Distinguished Chair in International Politics and National Security in the Department of Political Science at SMU. Chip Pitts is the former chair of Amnesty International USA, now teaches corporate social responsibility at Stanford Law School and Oxford University, and he serves on the board of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Both of them will take part in a panel discussion sponsored by the Press Club of Dallas this evening called The Legacies of 9/11, 10 Years Later. Registration starts at 5 in the community room at the KERA studio, with the program beginning at 6:15. Siyam, Chip, welcome to Think.
Good to be here.
In order to understand the entire decade since 9/11, do we really have to go in phases? Do we have to look at the initial shock of things and then the expansion of security and the military activity? Or can we sort of take it all as one thing and look at it as a whole 10 years later?
I think we can look at it as a whole, but it has these various parts that fed into one another, sometimes contradicted one another. And we have the legacy of it today, mm-hmm, that we're living with and, in many respects, I would say, trying to overcome. But I think that one of the immediate effects of it was that it brought the country together as a caring mutual community of mutual care. That was the good part of it. But at the same time, I think what it did was it energized the crazies on both sides. Terrorism and counterterrorism became the way of conducting our international affairs. It became the priority for U.S. foreign policy. And I think, as we'll discuss, distorted, I think, U.S. foreign policy as well as some of our national values.
And I would agree with that. I also think there are elements, Chris, that like the analogy of frogs in boiling water. So it snuck up on us. And I would go even beyond Sam's point. It's not just even foreign policy. I think it's changed domestic policy and, in many ways, the very character of our nation. I think that we've become a radically less open society. We're obviously much more accepting of surveillance. As we were discussing before the show, the current youngest generation grew up not knowing what it's like to walk on an airplane unchecked, or to not have their calls surveilled. It's just the new normal in America. And that really changes the very nature of the country.
I want to talk about these things called national security letters, which were relatively rare. They did exist before 9/11, but they were relatively rare. There have been hundreds of thousands of them issued over the past decade. Can you talk a little bit about what they are and what they mean to all of us?
Sure. They were expanded by Section 505 of the Patriot Act. And they're also known as an administrative subpoena. And they're quite problematic from a legal perspective because they sidestep the Fourth Amendment's requirement of probable cause and individualized suspicion before a search is done. As you know, the Fourth Amendment says you've got to have a reasonable search, usually with warrant and a probable cause standard, that there's some reason to seize the objects or such, search the papers of the target. In this case, for a whole new classes of business records, financial records, car, travel, tourist records, there have been a lot of abuses, and the Inspector General of the Department of Justice has now written several reports showing that a single letter, for example, can cover tens of thousands of people. And as you say, there have been hundreds of thousands of these letters. So businesses do not know when they receive these letters from the FBI that they can actually challenge them in court. And first, in fact, you could not challenge them. The 2005 amendments to the Patriot Act allowed them to be challenged if you know enough to do so. And now the gag order allows you – there's an amendment that allows you to talk to your attorney for the purposes of challenging them. But by and large, businesses don't even realize that. They receive the letter and they comply. And Internet service providers – this is one of the most serious abuses – will now turn over wholesale electronic communications. They'll receive a letter that's too broad, or they'll respond in too broad a fashion, and so they'll turn over entire troves of emails pertaining to a class of subjects, the person that's the target of the letter, but also everyone they've communicated with. And now it applies to personal digital assistants, BlackBerries and iPhones and so forth. So it's a really problematic letter. I personally think the entire category should be eliminated because I think there are serious constitutional defects with it.
Yet there are a lot of pressures. The fact of terrorism, and it's coming with some of the innovations in technology, I think push us more toward the Big Brother intrusive state than anything else has in the past. The Cold War did to a degree, but since terrorists are regarded as emerging out of civilian population rather than people who necessarily wear uniforms, more so than any other time, and now we have the technologies for it. Yes, we've got the Patriot Act and we've got some things that can be repealed because they go too far. But I think that there is a larger danger that pits the notion of national security against civil liberties. That's part of the age we live in, and it's going to be increasingly difficult to manage.
It's been interesting that a lot of people had assumed that the Obama administration would reverse some of the additional powers taken on by the Bush administration, and in fact, that has not been the case. Was either one of you surprised to find that 9/11 was almost immediately politicized?
Politicized in the sense that...
Well, it became a sort of a, not just the you're with us or you're against us set of arguments, but in terms of the response to things, questions were not simply what's the best way to handle this, but it also has been really, the defense against terrorism has been a target of political activity, and that's sort of a way that people use to define themselves against one another.
Right, but this did create a surprise on the part of some of us that Obama moved rather substantially in the direction of embracing a lot of the Bush policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the ways it's changed our politics, as you both alluded to. Mm-hmm. It's actually been a factor, not the most important, but one of the factors that has resulted in this radically dysfunctional, polarized politics we have, because you've got irrational notions, these overbroad techniques like the national security letters that have actually resulted in counterproductive security aspects. You're basically increasing the ratio of noise to signal. You're getting a lot of irrelevant information by adding not just needles to the haystacks, but exponentially more haystacks by all this new information. It's leading to data overload, and that's why with the NSLs, the national security letters, even the FBI officials are objecting that it's sending them on wild goose chases a lot of times. And they're not getting the benefits expected. But what's happened is Obama, being a Democrat, and a former constitutional law professor, one would not have expected this. It was surprising. But he's ended up not only embracing but in some ways expanding some of the core Bush notions in areas like suspicious activity reports. Janet Napolitano now has the Homeland Security Secretary now has a program that says, see something, say something. That's the idea of informants, Soviet-style informants on your neighbors. It obviously leads to a lot of misinformation, a lot of, personal vendetta type of misinformation or scurrilous information on neighbors for revenge reasons, etc. And yet that same program was defeated three times when John Ashcroft tried it, then Alberto Gonzalez tried it under the Bush administration. So in that respect and others, in order to not seem soft on terror, Obama and the Democrats in Congress have actually taken a more hardline position. And it leads to a sort of self-perpetuating contest as who can have the harsher, the strongest approach toward counterterror. And again, it's led to an irrationality that's not really looking at effectiveness of the techniques.
Yeah, I think it, however, cannot be entirely attributed to politics. Mm-hmm. I think Obama, from where he sits now, receives every day briefings on various kinds of plots, like the underwear bomber plot, like various of the plots to blow up airliners flying across the Atlantic and so on. He gets these briefings all the time, and from where he sits, it's scary for the nation, and he's got to be responsive to a lot of the pressures to surveil civilians much more than he would have not being in office. I think he sees it differently. Obama, it appears to me, can tell you that it's not simply politics, but it's a rational response. Now, that doesn't mean that everything he's endorsing is rational, but it shouldn't be too surprising to us that he's moved in that direction, even though it was.
I think it's a little – I mean, it gets into the semantics of what's rational. Mm-hmm. Rationality includes our evolutionary characteristics derived characteristics like our tendency to emphasize salient events, what cognitive scientists call the availability heuristic. And that's, you know, 9/11 is the preeminent example of that. All of us have seared in our memories, those of us that saw it, you know, real time, seared in our memories the images of the first tower and the second tower falling. And as, you know, behavioral scientists and psychologists have said, like, Tversky and Kahneman, these influence our behavior and they lead to an unconscious, irrational, emotional level reaction. And in this case, we've institutionalized, in my opinion, a culture of fear. And that leads to this, for example, the Abdul-Muttalib example you gave. Obama has this imperative that he must do something. And so they rely on these techno-utopian solutions, you know, multiply the data streams enormously. But in that case, there were three pieces of data that, again, the dots were there and they weren't connected, including the underwear bomber's own father saying that he was about to attack the U.S. And those dots weren't connected, and he almost got away with it. And it was a passenger on the plane that stopped him, not any of the hundreds of billions of dollars that was spent on, you know, fancy surveillance equipment and all that.
Right, but I think that irrationality is a product of from where he sits and his feeling that he's responsible for, particularly if they're successful ventures of the kinds that were interrupted. Fears can be somewhat irrational, and the policies he endorses somewhat irrational. But again, I think that it's too easy to attribute this to political motivation rather than that deeper fear, irrational or not.
Yeah, part of the fear is that you should not be seen as appearing soft on terror, and that could be political. But there's obviously a rational desire to do whatever you can to stop the next attacks. And I think that, you know, we're too easily accepting that a lot of these harsh, overbroad methods that, you know, reverse the presumption of innocence, increase the streams of data, make it more difficult to connect the dots, that those are rational. I think now, 10 years later, we should be able to reflect and say, is this really working? Or is it actually causing, you know, a failure to see and really act effectively against these events? It's sort of lucky that we were able to stop attacks like that one. It was lucky that Shahrzad's Times Square bomb did not go off. It was lucky that the Fort Hood shooter did not kill more people and so forth.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting parallel, I think, when you look back on the Cold War and the fear that now, to a certain extent, seems irrational to us now that we have all the information available and we sort of know what was going on behind closed doors, behind the Iron Curtain. Have we simply, to your point earlier, Siam, that we've allowed our fear of terrorism to guide a great deal of our foreign policy decisions and statecraft? Have we simply traded the irrational fears of the Cold War based in some reasonable concerns for irrational fears of terrorism?
Rather than the fears being irrational, it appears to me that the instruments that we've adopted to go after the terrorists need to be criticized, even if those fears have a certain amount of legitimacy. I think that we have enhanced the role of force, military power in U.S. foreign policy, much more than we should have. During the Cold War, it had a more justifiable reason because our principal enemy had a tremendous amount of firepower, a tremendous amount of military force that they could use or they could support proxy wars with. It was that kind of necessity. Now, going after terrorists, we're using blunt instruments that might have been appropriate for that earlier era, but are not really appropriate for going after terrorists. Our regime change operations in both in Iraq and Afghanistan were blunt operations. They assumed that once you defeated your enemy on the ground and his legions, that then you could achieve the kind of regime that you wanted. This was turned out to be a vast illusion.
My guests are Siam Brown of SMU and Chip Pitts of Stanford Law School and Oxford University. We're talking about the legacies of 9/11 10 years later. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the legacies of 9/11 10 years later. This is also the title of a panel discussion sponsored by the Press Club of Dallas, which will take place tonight at the KERA studios. Registration starts at 5 and the program begins at 6:15. My guests this hour are Sion Brown, who is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Chair in International Politics and National Security in the Department of Political Science at SMU. Chip Pitts is here as well. He is former chair of Amnesty International USA, now teaches corporate social responsibility at Stanford Law School and Oxford University, and he serves on the board of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And Chip, you wanted to follow up on what Siam was saying about the changes in the way we use military force broadly in some cases to a very targeted problem.
Exactly, and I want to fully agree with what Siam was saying about the overbroad nature of some of these tools, including the easy recourse to these perpetual continuing wars now. The global war on terror, which is a flawed concept, I would argue. It's, you know, flawed for all the reasons people say. It's a war on a tactic. It's endless in geography and in time if you truly try to eliminate something like terror or evil. But more than that, I think that we actually do need to look at the underlying risk and take a clearer, more rational look at the risk. The problem with the fear response, really operating from the amygdala, the oldest part of the brain, you know, the fight or flight syndrome, is that you don't see things clearly. You literally cannot see that there have only been a handful of incidents since 9/11, even in the world at large. You know, they're terrible as they are, but from a risk management perspective, you must see things clearly. And there are tens of thousands of people that die on our nation's highways every year, about 30,000 a year. There are millions of violent crimes. We don't have the same reaction of spending trillions of dollars in often counterproductive, duplicative, ineffective, inefficient ways in order to respond to these. So it's the problem with the tools, ranging from war to things like these body scanners that don't even work to pick up the plastic explosives that they were supposedly designed to pick up. They weren't, in fact, designed to pick up the PETN that Abdul Muttalib, the underwear bomber, used. But it's also, we need to really remember that we were the land of the free and the home of the brave. And we're forgetting the need to put risk in perspective. And any good risk management approach, whether it's a corporate risk management or a military or a political risk management approach, must start with a clear vision of what the actual risks are.
In addition, it appears to me, to adopting the wrong military tools, it appears to me we also adopted an overly gross ideology, analogous possibly to what happened during the Cold War, but now even more inappropriate. 9/11 actually provided the opportunity for the neoconservatives to capture the mind of George Bush. This the doctrine that they put forward of regime change around the world, having a noble purpose, of course, to bring democracy and market economies around the world, turned out to be a singularly inappropriate doctrine for the complex threats that were emerging and their sources. You know, the neoconservatives were arguing that the United States should give high priority around the world to the installation of market democracies, peacefully if possible, but by force if necessary. And by doing that, we were going to eliminate a lot of the threats to international peace and security, presumably also terrorism. Democracies don't fight each other. They gleaned from some social science literature. And that now the basic strategy of the United States should be going around the world changing regimes. 9/11 provided them with the opportunity to say, okay, we've got a couple of target regimes to knock out. Some of them in Bush's immediate entourage wanted Iraq first, but others said, no, wait a minute, we don't quite have the goods yet to do that, the ideological goods also. Let's go after the enclave of terrorism in Afghanistan first. But they wanted to do regime change, not simply to knock out the terrorists, not simply to engage in that kind of operation that might have been more effective. So the whole thing has become ideologicalized rather than a police operation against criminals who deserve to be apprehended and prosecuted.
I would agree with that. And I'd add to it that, you know, it creates a couple of problems. One is that the actual results, again, even from the freedom and democracy promoting agenda, are counterproductive. You know, I actually think there's a germ of truth, an important germ of truth in George Bush and Condoleezza Rice's insights that human rights violations are, at least in theory, you know, they said that, you know, that we've got to promote democracy and liberal societies because that can remove the root causes of terror. I think that's actually quite true. But the problem is that we've seen a regression, according to Freedom House and other, you know, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, a regression in rights and the rule of law worldwide since the war on terror began. In addition to that, this aggressive approach that you're talking about, ideologically driven approach of regime change, can produce terrible national security consequences. Right now, what lessons do you think that rogue regimes are learning from Libya? You know, Gaddafi gave up his nuclear arms through negotiation with the UK and the US a few years back, and now he's being invaded and the UN resolution has morphed from a defense of civilians humanitarian intervention to regime change. And that I think, produces a real risk of increased proliferation in the world and ultimately a greater likelihood that nuclear weapons could be used by terrorists.
Are policymakers in this country now appropriately aware of the vulnerability of our image in the world?
I think they have to be. And what their reaction to it is another matter. But I think that's evident by all kinds of opinion polls, even after some successes. You know, even after the apprehension and killing of Osama bin Laden. Our popularity, by most polls that I've seen, is at a low ebb.
Yeah, I think this, and then the economic implications—the fact that we've gone into debt to the tune of trillions of dollars, trillion just for DHS and Homeland Security alone. Joe Stiglitz estimates $4 trillion in connection with what was spent on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan today, plus the follow-on consequences. You know, these economic consequences are themselves a genuine national security threat to the future of the nation. But in addition to that, we have had a calamitous cost of our soft power. I think that things like the drone attacks in Pakistan, you know, putting aside the debate on whether they're legal or not, and I think there are serious legal issues to going into a country with which we're not at war and killing civilians with the high levels of collateral damage. Both Pakistani diplomats, the NGOs there that I've talked to, are quite concerned about that. And, of course, that's been a huge driver for the radicalization of that nation, the extreme levels of anti-Americanism, a part of which will include people that turn to terrorism. And so this loss of moral legitimacy of our soft power by turning to coercive interrogation or torture, to renditions and kidnapping, to secret prisons, to Gitmo, to not close Gitmo, which was really just going to be moving it north here to the United States, but to keep that open. And then to do the other things like the drone attacks that we're doing are just, again, to me, it seems quite clear that they're counterproductive. But you've even had now former Homeland Security Director Dennis Blair come out against the drone attacks as saying that they're counterproductive. He did an op-ed, and I think it was the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal that effect just a few weeks ago. So we really have to think about, you know, in terms of the future of our nation, if we're going to continue to have competitive advantages and to have prosperity and security, to attract immigrants, to be perceived as a leader in the world, to have freedom of action on a whole array of foreign policy fronts to achieve our goals, we really need to pay attention to our brand just as a corporation would. And that brand is definitely hurt by undermining the rule of law and undermining the fundamental human rights that we say we adhere to.
We've talked about military aggression today, but there's also the reality that our military is now expected to do a lot of things that in the past it would never have been trained for or asked to do, some of which have to do with a kind of grassroots diplomacy, with winning hearts and minds. Is this a good way to move our military strategy, or is this really just taking people who would be better off doing a particular job and asking them to add on a set of responsibilities for which they are not appropriately trained?
I think it's part of a larger problem that it's painful to examine, but I think we need to examine. And that is that we are giving the military a role in transformation of societies around the world. We're giving them a role because, A, we can get them there easily. They organize themselves better. They've got more resources. They're better funded than the State Department or AID and so on. But I think we need to examine the whole role, whether it's the military or other agencies of the government that the United States has taken on for itself in this post-Cold War era. We have taken on the role of being the world's policeman, but also the world's reformer, political teacher, teacher of how to design an economy and a society along with it, we have taken on a quasi-imperialist role in the world. And I think we need to take another look at this, whether or not we are really capable with respect to the skills that requires, whether or not we should be doing it. That's a moral and ethical question as well. The British and the French found out in an earlier era that they weren't really capable of holding on, and they shouldn't be doing it either. I think we need to have a very stark and fresh look at this whole question as to what we're trying to do in the world.
I agree. And my visits to the theaters of war like Afghanistan and Iraq have convinced me that, you know, we don't have any leaders more competent, more capable than our military. They're so much more impressive, frankly, than our political and business leaders. However, the mission they've been given, the mission of nation building, of winning hearts and minds, I think it's inherently contradictory to the military's core function, which is defense, which involves killing people. And as a result, they just haven't succeeded. You know, the Afghanistan effort's now the longest war in U.S. history. And, you know, it's quite clear there's not going to be a military solution, but it's also quite clear that we're not going to have an easy political solution with the military trying to be negotiators. I asked some of the generals there. They haven't had training in negotiation, and yet they're there, you know, negotiating conflicts with the Kurds, with the, you know, the Turkmen, and trying to hold together this very volatile situation, investing in schools and roads and other civilian-type infrastructure projects, and they're out of their depth there. They're starting to get better at it, but it's just not realistic to think that that's going to work. And I also agree with Sam that this is sort of the last gasp of imperialism. We cannot continue to be an imperial power with having, you know, expanded since the War on Terror bases around the world, as Chalmers Johnson and others have noted, and expect that we will, you know, we'll be able to achieve our purposes using that technique. It's not going to be neo-imperialism. It's going to be the sort of magnetic appeal of authentic values, true leadership, other-oriented leadership that isn't using the military to try to bring people up, but using real experts in development and anti-poverty and health and education and welfare, women's rights. That's what we really need to focus our efforts more on, I believe.
And I think Obama's instincts have been correct in this. I think he's wanted to move away from nation building as the basic definition of why we are in Iraq, why we are in Afghanistan, why we went into Libya, and so on. I think his instincts are, no, we don't want to do that. It is too much of a drain on our own resources, our own capabilities. But more than that, we don't really know how to do it.
So I spent some time looking around for this, and I couldn't find a survey that was taken before 9/11 that evaluated how many Americans knew the difference between Sunni and Shia or knew that the two things even mattered. But one thing that has inarguably changed since 9/11 is the degree of familiarity that our military, our elected leaders, and even just regular civilians have or believe they have with Islam. How accurate are those perceptions, and to what extent do they drive the way we conduct ourselves in terms of domestic security and also in terms of international relations?
Well, I think one of the national shames is the way we have approached the whole issue of Islam. You know, we have basically had a new era of Islamophobia, xenophobia, and it extends to other populations as well. Anti-immigrant sentiment, African-Americans are targeted, people that look like Muslims. Here in Dallas after 9/11, of course, we had famous incidents where Sikhs in turbans were thought to be Muslims and so were killed right here. And so I think it's important to realize that that's something we have to correct, this simple and really despicable equation of Islam in general, Muslims in general, with terrorism of the sort you hear on Fox TV. You know, Bill O'Reilly famously says it was Muslims that attacked us on 9/11, and then he said this on The View, and then a couple of people, Whoopi and Joy, walked off. Whoopi and Joy weren't very happy, despite their names, with that statement. We've got to get a reality-based perspective on the Muslim world. So now there's a little bit more understanding of Sunni and Shia, for example. But there's still a disturbing tendency, and I've personally heard, even in the last year, people from the FBI say Muslims are out to get us. And it's just absurd. And it's counterproductive because these are the people, you know, they are, to the extent that there are Islamic terrorists involved, and of course not all terrorism is Islamic, as the Norwegian incident recently reminds us, not to mention the Oklahoma bombing and other Christian fundamentalist anti-abortion terrorist attacks and so forth. But we really have to understand that Muslims, both abroad and at home, are some of our best allies to get the intelligence we need. After all, again, with the underwear bomber, it was his father from Nigeria, a Muslim from Nigeria, that called saying, you know, you should be concerned about my son.
Also, the Islamic world is terribly, terribly complex. We've become a little bit more sophisticated. We know the difference between Sunni and Shia, but we don't necessarily know of all of the varieties of Sunnis and all of the varieties of Shia who sometimes fight one another. We were surprised by what then became the surge in Iraq and looked like it was giving us success. It was a group of Sunnis that decided that the al-Qaeda's in their mix were going too far. And so they became part of what was called the Sunni Awakening and began to side with the Shias and with us in going against a more radical element of the Sunnis. Now, we were lucky in that it seemed to turn out right. But throughout the Islamic world, there are these complexities. We, for example, simplify a little bit. Well, we're not against all Muslims, but we're against the jihadists. Well, that's an oversimplification of what jihad is. Some jihadists are peaceful. They believe they're for total transformation of the individual from the inside and not for killing. When we get mixed up into these battles and when we deploy and even attempt to mediate some of these battles, we become part of the conflicts that are there, and we find out that we don't really even understand who's on whose side on what issues.
C.M. Brown is my guest. He's John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Chair in International Politics and National Security in the Department of Political Science at SMU. Chip Pitts is former chair of Amnesty International USA. He now teaches corporate social responsibility at Stanford Law School and Oxford University. Both will speak tonight at a panel discussion sponsored by the Press Club of Dallas that takes place at the KERA studios. Registration starts at 5. The program begins at 6:15. We'll come back to this conversation in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the legacies of 9/11 10 years later with C.M. Brown of SMU and Chip Pitts of Stanford Law School and Oxford University. Both will participate this evening at a panel discussion sponsored by the Press Club of Dallas. You can find more information about that at pressclubdallas.com. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Eric in Fort Worth, who asks if you would both speak to the role of the state's capacity in regard to the increased likelihood of both experiencing terror attacks, I'm guessing against the United States, and being the base in the United States for the launching of transnational attacks.
Could Eric just elaborate that a little bit?
Well, it's an email.
Terrorism. It's about state terrorism, yeah. His question. And certainly I think this is something that is important to recognize, is that states can act in a terror type way. And of course, one man's terrorist is another freedom fighter, right? I mean, we had Nelson Mandela of the ANC, who both I and Barack Obama supported when he was with the ANC, and he was on the terrorist watch list until 2008 in this country. And so, you know, we actually have seen state terror. And from the perspective of the victim on the ground, and just put yourself in the position of someone in Afghanistan who doesn't have a television, maybe they're a farmer or raised sheep, and they have these robotic drones raining on them from the sky. It kills everyone in their wedding party. and they know the U.S. is involved, but they've never even heard of 9/11, as an astounding a number of people in Afghanistan are completely ignorant of the attacks on 9/11. What do you think that makes them feel, and what will be their reaction be? They're going to react against foreign invaders and state terrorists from their perspective. And that's the problem. When you have these overbroad, harsh actions, it's not just individuals that can be terrorists. It actually can be states.
Yes, and although the Taliban, I think, have been terrorizing more than our soldiers have, nonetheless, there are about 250,000 civilians that have been caught in the crossfire one way or another. Tremendous amount of killing going on in Afghanistan. And sometimes it's our bullets, sometimes it's their bullets. Sometimes it's an explosion that wipes out a whole house where there are civilians. So this is the nature of what's going on. And we are, as a state, fighting what we regard as a legitimate war, inflicting the kind of suffering that the victims will regard as terrorism.
And let's reflect on that for a minute. You know, 3,000 people approximately died on 9/11. And the response, and I've heard different statistics, they vary between 150,000 to about a million of civilian casualties in conjunction with the war. And now we have this policy of assassinating people around the world, you know, not just in the actual battlefield theaters of Iraq and Afghanistan, but the JSOC forces that Dana Priest and William Arkin wrote about, and they have a new chapter about in their Top Secret America book that just came out in the last week or so. These forces are now authorized to create their own kill list, and these include American citizens who are targeted. There were four, according to the Washington Post, four American citizens on these lists. And, you know, for that kind of state-sponsored killing of people around the world, that's unprecedented to my knowledge in history. You know, for this sort of global reach and being able to assassinate people anywhere in the world, you can debate whether it's a legal targeted killing or an extrajudicial killing. It's certainly extrajudicial, but it also certainly doesn't involve due process of law. It doesn't involve a fair trial. You can't even be sure if you get the right person if you don't contest the evidence. And right now, the intelligence services are looking at the evidence themselves, their own lawyers are, but they have another heuristic, another cognitive bias, confirmation bias. They tend to all be on the same wavelength of saying, this is the way that we're going to win the war on terror. And again, the collateral damage estimates are a lot more problematic than people recognize, and that's producing a harsh counterreaction and a terrorist response at the margins.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Alex on the line in Dallas. Hello, Alex.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if your panelists could respond to a report out of San Francisco that the San Francisco PD permitted two Apple company security officials to enter the home of somebody who was suspected of having a copy of the latest iPhone prototype, and whether or not they think that would have been permitted 10 years ago, and whether technology has advanced to the point where everyone is subject to searches such as that.
I think it's a good point, is that, first of all, it calls to mind the cooperation of the public and private sector and private military contractors who have an incentive for profit and continuing war in order to sell technologies to them. The iPhone, by the way, is used throughout these theaters abroad. And so it's an accessory that's handed to people, whether they're in the intelligence side or the normal military side abroad. I do think that the caller is right, is that sort of cooperation, which was initially denied by the San Francisco Police Department, they said that they didn't, you know, cooperate with Apple, and they, under pressure, admitted they did. I think that there is a new norm that allows that sort of intrusion. You know, the Patriot Act is now mainly permanent. There were three provisions that were up for renewal, the roving wiretaps, the lone wolf provision, and the so-called business or library records provision. They were all renewed again, and that's been a permanent law. It was originally supposed to be an emergency-based law. No one read it, and yet that's now effectively permanent unless citizens get involved in challenging this new norm. One of the things the Patriot Act allows is secret black bag searches of homes by law enforcement officials, the FBI. But what's happened is this new cooperation, half of the contractors or half of the personnel of the CIA, the NSA, half of the personnel in Afghanistan are private security contractors. Half the personnel in Iraq, until the recent withdrawal, were private security contractors. Now it's twice as many. We've got about 40,000 troops there. There are about 90,000 contractors in Iraq as we get out of Iraq. And so this privatization of the war effort and the new norm of surveillance and using technology to surveil from the private sector is very problematic. And I don't know whether it would have happened 10 years ago, but it certainly would have been a lot more difficult when you had a robust definition of probable cause and, you know, judicial review before such searches.
If you or I or any of us land on somebody's watch list and records are subpoenaed from our phone companies and our ISPs, do we have any right or even any ability to know this is going on before an indictment is filed?
We may not know.
Short answer is no. You don't know because of the secrecy. Mm-hmm. You know, under the gag orders of the NSLs, that's one way they can get these records. No probable cause required. A mere interest from the FBI can trigger this national security letter. And usually the people aren't informed. But another way the records are accessed are through FISA warrants, these secret warrants by the secret FISA court that hardly ever denies the request of law enforcement. I mean, literally hardly ever. In tens of thousands of times, the warrants have been requested. And these are warrants that don't require the traditional probable cause that there's some fact-based reason to suspect them of a crime or terrorism. It's just a fact-based inquiry based on the probable cause that they are an agent of a foreign power, for example. And people never know about those. You're not given notice or an opportunity to object. In addition to that, right now the FBI maintains the so-called Guardian database, which already has 100 million records in it of U.S. citizens. And often these include biometric records because all the service members give their biometric, their fingerprint scans. They take scans of people coming in at the border now routinely as they do in Japan. You know, your iris scan, your fingerprint scan. This is becoming, again, part of the new normal. And the problem is that it's done in secret. If you're on the no-fly list, it's incredibly difficult to get off that list. So citizens don't know increasingly in this secret environment what information the government has on them, and so they can't challenge it effectively.
Is whatever evidence is recovered actually always admissible in court, or is this are there special circumstances for that?
You've hit on a core ambiguity at the heart of this whole global war on terror. You know, the idea was that the FBI was trying to get information for criminal purposes so it would be evidence that would be publicly available for prosecution, challengeable, contestable in court. Now the FBI, as well as the CIA and these other 16 or 17 intelligence agencies in the U.S., they gathered data independent of whether there's a criminal investigation or not. Sometimes with these suspicious activity reports, and there are hundreds of thousands of people who have been reported by local police, by their neighbors under this new Obama initiative, the SAR, suspicious activity reports. Banks report if there's a certain amount of cash that exceeds the limit. They'll report under the Patriot Act suspicious activities just from the amount of cash. And so these are all going into these databases that fusion centers have, that these different agencies of government described in Top Secret America by Priest and Arkin in their book. And that's a Frontline documentary as well that's just coming out in connection with the anniversary of the attacks. These are unknown to people, and it's very difficult to challenge them as a result. We need to put in what are called fair information privacy practices that say things like the information can't be gathered without a legitimate purpose that ought to be, in my opinion, constitutional as well as statutorily authorized by law. And there does need to be a way to minimize the data, to limit the time it's held, even if it's legitimately gathered, and then to have people know that it's been gathered on them at a certain point. Now, if there's a real probable cause, fact-based suspicion someone's a criminal or a terrorist, you wouldn't want to do that. But most of the people in these databases are not even suspicious, really. They're reports without a criminal predicate at all. They're not even suspected of a crime. What happens is someone will take a picture of a ferry, for example, and then they'll get in the database because somebody has reported them, either a citizen or a police officer. And that happens hundreds of thousands of times a year. It's incredible. And there are now millions of reports. The NSA alone receives 1.7 billion pieces of information within a 24-hour period. Hmm. So it's becoming information overload.
This is one of the unfortunate legacies of 9/11, and that is that not only do we not know, but we have become, as a society, more passive in face of these intrusions. In a way, ironically, Osama bin Laden accomplished one of his purposes, and that is that he's compelled us to to put it possibly in too large a way, he's compelled us to lose our soul, as it were.
Here.
The patriots are the ones who support these kinds of intrusions, whereas those who oppose them are regarded in many quarters as being unpatriotic.
I don't want to sound crass here, but I do want to go back to the money question for a moment, because domestically alone, the LA Times had a piece last week that we are spending $75 billion a year on enhancements to domestic security. And I think very few people would object to extra protections around federal buildings and at airports and you know, terminals. But there's also money being spent in places that very few people would consider a serious target for terrorism. What do we need to evaluate when we decide where spending really is appropriate and necessary and where money is just being sort of thrown away?
Well, it is a wasteful thing. Last week, there was a congressional independent inquiry that said it was up to $60 billion of funds wasted or subject to, you know, fraud or abuse in connection with Iraq and Afghanistan. But in addition to that, you have this Homeland Security gravy train.
Let me just interrupt. Was that a GAO report? Or
no, it was an independent congressional investigation on private contracting. And it's easy to Google. The figure was between $31 billion, conservative estimate, more likely $61 or more billion dollars just wasted, you know, through blatant fraud of contractors. And we've seen the same things. When you have 72 fusion centers in the United States, they're all buying duplicative equipment. They're not even having enough terrorist-related activities to work on, so they're working on petty crimes. You know, it's really a Keystone Cops type picture, in my opinion. There's a tremendous waste of not just billions, but trillions, in my opinion, based again on reports like that in the Washington Post by Priest and Arkin of Homeland Security funding that is, you know, based on fancy bells and whistle video monitors, literally designed by Disney Company. You know, that's the counterterrorism and contractor for their video monitors. They're very impressive. They look like the fancy TV shows, but often they're just sitting there, and they're not only actively ineffective, they're counterproductive because they give you a false sense of security, and they lead you to rely on these techno-utopian devices and supposed solutions that don't work, like the body scanners that don't work, instead of the hard, old-fashioned law enforcement police work that does work.
That leaves the last word to you, Sam, if you choose to take it. We've got about 40 seconds to go.
Well, I think that these discussions that we're having on the 10th anniversary can be salutary if they stimulate the kind of rethinking that we're trying to generate here in talking with you. It can be a valuable anniversary in that sense. Insofar as it rekindles, however, the passions of revenge, of getting even, and domestic and international polarization, it will be part of the tragedy, a tragedy of noble motives leading to bad outcomes.
C.M. Brown is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Chair in International Politics and National Security in the Department of Political Science at SMU. Chip Pitts is former chair of Amnesty International, now teaches corporate social responsibility at Stanford Law School and Oxford University, and serves on the board of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Both will take part this evening at 5 in a panel discussion called The Legacies of 9/11, 10 Years Later, sponsored by the Press Club of Dallas. Gentlemen, it's always great to have you on the program. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.